Chapter 14. CIA versus Congress. It was back in September, while I was writing a cable digging for more information about Senator Clark's tour of Southern Africa, that I first began to understand the agency's manipulative attitude towards Congress. Clark, the chairman of the Subcommittee on African Affairs of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was touring Southern Africa from Tanzania south and back up to Zaire, meeting African chiefs of state and our ambassadors, seeking to understand the issues in Angola. Before his departure, on August 4, 1975, Senator Clark had been briefed by Director Colby about the Angola program. Colby had explained our objectives in terms of the original 40 Committee Charter. That is, that we were sending arms to replenish Mobutu's arsenal as he sent weapons into Angola. No American arms would be sent into Angola. No Americans would be involved in the conflict. The objective was to encourage Mobutu to prop up the FNLA and UNITA so they could resist the MPLA until elections could be held in October. As Senator Clark traveled, this IA feature cover story was being thoroughly tested. Insisting on consulting every principal involved, Clark was visiting Luanda, Kinshasa, and even Ambriz and Silva Porto, and talking to Neto, Roberto, Savimbi, and Mobutu. Ominous rumors were trickling back about his reaction. What if he chose to expose our program to the public, or go on record against it within the Senate? At headquarters, we wanted detailed reporting from the field about Clark's reactions. As I drafted the cable, I read through a soft file on Senator Clark and found a cable from headquarters to Kinshasa instructing the chief of station to see Mobutu and Holden Roberto and prep them for their meeting with Senator Clark. Footnote. Since the Freedom of Information Act, the agency increasingly uses a system of soft, unofficial, or convenience files for sensitive subjects, especially any involving surveillance of Americans. Such files are not registered in the agency's official record system, and hence can never be disclosed under the FOIA. End footnote. The COS should advise Mobutu and Roberto that Senator Clark had been briefed in very general terms about our program to help the Angolan Liberation Front leaders and to resupply Zaire, to make up for the aid it had given the Angolans. The cable stated that Senator Clark had agreed not to discuss the program in Zaire. Therefore, the two African politicians should be encouraged to promote their interests in Angola, confident that Senator Clark could not turn the conversation to the CIA program. After a staff meeting, as we walked back to the Africa Division offices, I asked my colleagues if we could get by with that sort of thing. What sort of thing? Someone asked. Coaching African politicians before they meet with one of our own senators. No one seemed to grasp my point, so I tried again. Senator Clark was sent by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to get the facts on Angola. Can we tell Africans he wants to meet what they should and should not tell him? A chorus of sharp voices pounded me. Clark shouldn't waste the taxpayers' money on such a trip. It was the agency's job to gather intelligence. We had already told Clark everything he needed to know about Angola. Besides, you couldn't trust senators any further than you could throw them, someone added, recalling an incident in Southeast Asia when a prominent senator had been briefed on the CIA program in detail and even shown up-country installations, and later publicly denied any knowledge of the program. If Clark was going to mess around our program, talking to Africans, then we damn well better see that our own agents put their best feet forward. Someone admitted that it wasn't very smart having a cable like that in the files. Footnote. Although the file on Senator Clark was soft, and therefore safe from Freedom of Information Act demands, the cable also appeared in the IA feature chronological files and in the computer which records every agency cable. End footnote. Eventually, we could expect the Senate to close the program down and investigate it. They just might get their hands on such a cable and kick up a fuss. Senator Clark returned from his trip skeptical of his CIA briefings and of the Angola program. He was concerned that we were secretly dragging the United States into a broad conflict with dangerous global implications. Specifically, he was concerned, A, that we were in fact sending arms directly into Angola, B, that Americans were involved in the conflict, and C, that the CIA was illegally collaborating with South Africa. However, Clark could not disprove our cover story, and he had few moves to make against us. He could not precipitate a public debate because he was now muzzled by the CIA. In receiving the CIA's briefing about IA feature, he had given his tacit oath not to expose the information he received. The atmosphere in Congress was such that he would be highly discredited with his colleagues, jeopardizing his effectiveness on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee if he spoke out. Dozens of other legislators were similarly entrapped, as Colby methodically continued his briefings throughout the program, 35 briefings altogether, between January 1975 and January 1976. Systematically, he misled congressmen about what we were doing in Angola, but nevertheless deprived them of the option of going public. Footnote. In Honorable Men, Colby claims, in a thesis that recurs throughout the book, that he worked with determination to make the CIA, quote, an integral part of our democratic system of checks and balances among the executive and Congress and the judiciary, end quote, by testifying before the congressional committees. And yet, while he was answering their questions about past CIA operations, he was feeding them patently false information about the ongoing Angolan operation, depriving them of the full information which they needed to perform their constitutional role. End footnote. This was the flaw of the Hughes-Ryan Amendment, aside from the fact that it did not specify that CIA briefings of congressional committees must be complete or accurate. Quietly, Clark continued to watch the Angola program, trying to discern the truth through our shields of secrecy and falsehood. In early November, he queried the State Department about the Angolan conflict and was told that Mobutu was not using United States aid to support the Angolan factions. On November 8th, Colby defended the Angola program to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, repeating the party line that we were delivering arms to Mobutu, who was supplying the two Angolan factions, etc. On December 12th, Colby reassured the House Intelligence Committee that there were no Americans involved in Angola. The only weapon left to Senator Clark was the Senate's indirect control of the CIA budget. On December 5th, Clark recommended to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that it vote to terminate American involvement in Angola. The committee agreed, stirred to anger when a spokesman of the working group was exposed flagrantly lying to the committee. Bill Nelson, the CIA Deputy Director of Operations, and Ed Mulcahy, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, had been summoned to testify. Before Mulcahy arrived, Nelson was questioned and admitted the truth that the CIA was sending arms directly into Angola. Footnote. On November 3rd, Colby had been fired impetuously by President Ford, who then had been obliged to reverse himself and ask Colby to stay on until the congressional hearings were completed and a successor could be named. Thus, on December 5th, Bill Nelson, who was a Colby protege, knew that his own days of power were numbered. Only he could tell if this influenced him to betray Colby's IA feature cover story and tell the Senate the truth. Certainly, it must have been a difficult decision for Nelson to make. Richard Helms, a former director, was under investigation of perjury for lying to the Senate, and by December 5th, it was a safe conclusion that any false testimony about the Angola program might eventually be exposed. End footnote. Minutes after Nelson testified, Mulcahy arrived and testified, adhering to the working group line that arms were not being sent into Angola. Senator Clark confronted Mulcahy with Nelson's contradictory testimony and asked him to explain his apparent lie. Beneath the angry stares of committee members, Mulcahy kept his poise and calmly reversed himself, admitting that arms were being sent into Angola. Senator Case angrily denounced the lying. The committee unanimously endorsed Senator Clark's bill. The battle was thus joined. The administration lobbied for support for its proposed escalations in Angola. The CIA intensified its propaganda efforts, its agents focusing on New York and Washington. Our United Nations ambassador, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, noisily accused the Soviets of attempting to colonize Africa. Kissinger huffed publicly, "We have to be extremely tough, even brutal when they, the Soviets, step over the line." The senators could not answer publicly, muzzled as they were by the CIA. In silence, they focused on the CIA budget for the coming year. So far, the Angola program had been run from FY75 contingency funds, which had been approved by the Senate a year before. But the FY76 Defense Appropriations Bill was then before the Senate, and the CIA budget was buried in it. Senators John Tunney, Alan Cranston, and Dick Clark introduced an amendment which would prevent the use of any FY76 defense funds in Angola, except to gather intelligence. Clark pointed out that in Angola, quote, "We are dangerously close to an open-ended confrontation with the Soviet Union in a country that is of no real strategic concern to either country," end quote. The Tunney Amendment was approved by the Senate 54-22 on December 19th. And on January 27th, the House voted 323-99 in its favor. On February 9th, President Ford signed it into law. Footnote: the day before the Tunney Amendment was approved, on December 18th, my task force work was interrupted by an award ceremony in which I was given the CIA's Medal of Merit for my activities in Vietnam. The ceremonies were embarrassing to many who received them, who felt that the agency's conduct had been dishonorable and that the award ceremony was part of Colby's efforts to whitewash the episode. One young officer came to my office ahead of time, tearfully asking if I thought he should accept his medal. Another mimed that he would wear a paper bag over his head to cover his embarrassment. I myself called Colby's office and asked to be taken off the list of heroes, but was told Colby had decreed no one would be permitted to refuse his medal. Unwilling to jeopardize my position on the task force at this critical date, I walked across the stage and took the medal from Colby. He began his pat recitation of my heroism, but faltered as he looked me in the eye. At the door of the auditorium, a secretary took the medals back to hold in our files until our eventual retirement from the agency. In 1977, when I resigned, I quietly refused to take mine with me. End footnote. Once President Ford signed the Tunney Amendment into law, simultaneously overseas, the Angola program fell apart. The Cuban buildup accelerated in December and January. On November 11th, there were approximately 2,800 Cuban soldiers in Angola. By February, an air bridge they called Operation Carlotta had brought their numbers to at least 12,000. They moved as modern regular army units, with trucks, helicopters, tanks, armored cars, artillery support, and eventually MiG-21 jet fighter aircraft. In February, the Soviets' Angola program was estimated by the CIA to have reached $400 million. By mid-January of 1976, it had become clear to the South Africans that they would receive no public support for their Angolan effort, not even from Savimbi, who owed them so much. Realizing that the United States government would itself soon be forced to abandon its Angola program, and facing a Cuban MPLA force which was no longer a pushover, they gave up in disgust and retired back across the border as efficiently and quietly as they had come. Vorster's plan, putting in a small, covert force, had violated the cardinal rule of military strategy. the clear definition and pursuit of a desired objective. Emphatically, South Africa had been taught a hard lesson. Certain black African countries would accept its covert aid, but few sincerely bought its thesis of an African brotherhood which transcended racial issues. Despite the CIA's camaraderie, and despite whatever reassurances the South Africans felt they had received from the Ford administration, the United States had rejected their bid for overt support. Footnote: a U.S. Embassy cable from Cape Town on February 5, 1976, reported that United Party leader Sir de Villiers Graaf and Foreign Affairs spokesman Yapi Bason both noted to the visiting Bartlett congressional delegation, quote, "the general belief that South Africa had gone into Angola with some understanding that the United States intended to put up strong resistance to Soviet and Cuban intervention." End quote. End footnote. 3 months later, the United States joined in a critical vote against them in the United Nations Security Council. The South African military was bitter, feeling that it was discredited in the eyes of the world. The campaign had been expensive, costing the South African government $133 million. The damage to its white population's morale, the bitterness over the deaths of its soldiers in a secret, ill-conceived campaign in Angola, the humiliation of having two soldiers paraded before the Organization of African Unity in Addis Ababa, were all impossible to measure. 2 months later, in March 1976, the South Africans were obliged to turn the Kunene Hydroelectric Project over to the victorious MPLA. Footnote: see South Africa, Up Against the World, by John de Saint-Hore, Foreign Policy, No. 28, Fall, 1977. End footnote. In mid-January, the French announced their disengagement. The Zairean 7th and 4th Commandos continued straggling across the border into Zaire. An OAU summit meeting was scheduled for January 11th and 12th, 1976, and the United States became almost desperate to avoid censure by a majority of the African leaders. William Shaufell, the Undersecretary of State for African Affairs, began a hasty tour of Africa seeking support. President Ford sent personal letters to 32 African chiefs of state. Ambassador Moynihan continued to attack the Soviet program in the UN. The CIA marshaled every agent it could muster and sent them to Addis Ababa. A task force officer flew from Washington to Addis Ababa to bolster the CIA station's behind-the-scenes efforts to influence the outcome. Even then, the agency was greatly relieved to achieve a 22-22 deadlock tie in the voting on the Angolan issue. The relief was only temporary. Within 6 weeks, 41 of the 46 OAU members had recognized the MPLA government in Luanda. The military situation turned from bad to disastrous. Without South African armor and leadership, UNITA could not stand in the face of the Cuban MPLA advances. Savimbi reported one engagement east of Luso, which left him stoically incredulous at the Cubans' use of helicopters in a vertical envelopment. At night, the UNITA force had been facing several hundred Katangese troops, he said, and the next morning, they found a full battalion suddenly behind them, attacking from the rear and blocking their retreat. UNITA's position crumbled rapidly throughout central Angola. By February 1st, Savimbi was pushed back to Wambo and Silva Porto, not sure how long he could hold those. In Washington, the intent of the Senate was clear enough. It wanted to halt the Angola program. Technically, however, the Tunney Amendment only restricted future funds, and we still had $5 million of the original $31.7 million. The CIA urgently tried to use that money for more arms flights, while the administration sought to squeeze another $9 million out of the CIA's FY75 budget. The administration continued exhorting the CIA. In a 40-committee meeting in the White House Situation Room on January 6th, Bill Hyland, the deputy to the National Security Advisor to the President, instructed the CIA to concentrate on winning the war and urged the recruitment of mercenaries and the shipment of weapons like the C-47 gunships and 105mm howitzers to reverse the FNLA defeats. Five more C-141 arms flights went from Washington and France to Kinshasa, destined for Angola, between December 19, 1975, and January 29, 1976. On January 9th, we were desperately seeking to repaint a U.S. Air Force C-130 to deliver to the South Africans, along with the French helicopters, to encourage them to remain in Angola. Sensing our defiance, the Senate responded angrily. Senator Tunney wrote President Ford, threatening to review the budget if the Angolan activities did not cease. Senator Clark summoned Colby and Kissinger to answer blunt questions. Were Americans involved in the conflict? What was our relationship with South Africa? Kissinger said, among other things, quote, "The Soviet Union must not be given any opportunity to use military forces for aggressive purposes without running the risk of conflict with us." End quote. His testimony included several misleading and inaccurate statements. Even in mid-January, the senators did not have complete enough information, the whole truth, to refute his testimony. Only after February 9th, when the president's signature legalized the Tunney Amendment, did the CIA acknowledge defeat and begin to withdraw. The Portuguese commando force was terminated, and some of the IA feature temporary duty officers were ordered home from the field. But even then, after February 9th, the CIA continued making arms shipments into Angola, sending 22 additional flights from Kinshasa to the airstrip in Gago Coutinho in eastern Angola, delivering an additional 145,490 pounds of arms and ammunition. By early February, the FNLA had ceased to exist as a viable fighting force, and UNITA was crushed back to Wambo and Silva Porto. Savimbi came to the COS Kinshasa and asked for a clarification of United States policy and intentions. Should he attempt to fight for the cities, or should he revert to guerrilla warfare? St. Martin asked Savimbi if UNITA might not attempt to reach an understanding with the MPLA. St. Martin had participated in the CIA's effort to bring Savimbi back into line in September, when he had first attempted to open negotiations with the MPLA. Savimbi replied that he doubted the MPLA would be receptive under the present circumstances. St. Martin then relayed Savimbi's query to headquarters. No answer was available for 2 full weeks. In February, even after Ford had signed the Tunney Amendment into law, the White House and Kissinger were still seeking a miracle to reverse the tide of defeats, and they were casting about for public support for a major, overt escalation of the war. While discussions were being held in Washington, UNITA lost 600 soldiers in a crushing defeat at Wambo. When Washington finally answered, it encouraged Savimbi to continue fighting. On February 11th, the CIA spokesman promised Savimbi another $1 million in arms and money. On February 18, 1976, Secretary Kissinger sent the American chargé in Kinshasa a cable, instructing him to tell UNITA leaders that the United States would continue to support UNITA as long as it demonstrated the capacity for effective resistance to the MPLA. By that late date, Kissinger knew full well that we could provide no more support to UNITA. His message was perhaps an example of being, quote, tough, even brutal, end quote. As he had said in Senate testimony about his callous misuse of the Kurds, quote, "One must not confuse the intelligence business with missionary work," end quote. Footnote. In 1974 and 1975, the CIA, under orders from Kissinger, had mounted a program to arm and encourage the Kurdish people to revolt against the Iraqi government. This was done at the request of the Shah of Iran, who was contending with the Iraqis. When the Shah had reached a satisfactory understanding with the Iraqis, the CIA was called off, and it abruptly abandoned the Kurds, leaving them helpless, unable to defend themselves against bloody reprisals from the Iraqi army. Explaining this to the Church Committee, Kissinger made his now famous statement. End footnote. While Kissinger was drafting his cable, Savimbi was sending a letter of quite another kind to President Kenneth Kaunda of Zambia. Quote, UNITA lost 600 men in the battle for Huambo. The machine of war that Cuba and the Soviet Union have assembled in Angola is beyond the imagination. To prevent the total destruction of our forces, we have decided to revert immediately to guerrilla warfare. The friends, the CIA and United States, that have promised to help us did not fulfill their promises, and we must face our own fate with courage and determination. I have two requests for Your Excellency. One, no one is responsible for this disaster but the big powers. This is why, with my humble and limited understanding, I beg Your Excellency that my brother for years, Zambian Minister for Foreign Affairs, Rupiah Banda, be spared so that UNITA can be sacrificed, that is, at UNITA's expense. Rupiah is a big African, though very young. Two, I am sending with this my mother, who is 71 years old, so that she will be able to die in Zambia. My sister and three children, and my two children, are with my mother. Accompanying them are the wife of our Secretary General, with two children, and the wife of our Commanding General, with four children. The Political Bureau of Central Committee of UNITA joins me to thank you once more for everything. Whatever stand your government takes on Angola, we will accept with resignation. It is paramount that Zambia survives, and the love and admiration we have shared with my colleagues for your leadership and wisdom will be sufficient to comfort us in the dark days of our country. I would like to end this letter by asking Your Excellency to convey my greetings to Umwelimu, Tanzanian President, Jules Nyerere. I have read his interview concerning me. It is a pity that President Nyerere did not believe and know me. I have always tried to the best of my ability and courage to serve the interests of Angola and Africa. I am not a traitor to Africa, and the hard days that we expect ahead will prove to the world that I stand for my principles. In Angola, might has made right, but I will remain in the bush to cry for justice. God bless your beloved country. God bless you. Savimbi Jonas. End quote. In his last meeting with a CIA officer on February 1, 1976, Savimbi vowed never to leave the Angolan bush alive. Clearly, the administration, Henry Kissinger, and the CIA had been checked by a stubborn Congress. But how was the CIA doing with the Church and Pike committees and their devastating exposures? There seemed no end to the sordid tales coming to light about the agency. In late November 1975, more dramatic details of CIA assassination programs were leaked to the press by the Senate investigators. The CIA had been directly involved with the killers of Rafael Trujillo of the Dominican Republic, Ngo Diem of South Vietnam, and General Schneider of Chile. It had plotted the deaths of Fidel Castro and Patrice Lumumba. In the Lumumba assassination plot, the CIA was particularly diligent in its planning. Sid Gottlieb, chief of Technical Services Division and courier of the poison, had no sooner reached Kinshasa than headquarters had followed him with cables urging that the poison be given to Lumumba promptly before its power diminished. An agent was located who agreed to administer the fatal dose. A CIA staff officer, on the one hand, refused to do the killing, but on the other, did agree to lure Lumumba into a situation where he could be poisoned. The poison was not used, apparently because of difficulties in staging the killing. But a month later, on January 17, 1961, Lumumba was beaten to death by henchmen of Congolese politicians who had close relationships with the CIA. On December 19, 1975, while the Senate voted on Angola, the Olson family accepted $1.25 million in restitution for the death of Dr. Olson in CIA drug experiments. The money came from the U.S. taxpayer. The perpetrators of the crime, the directors of the CIA, the chief of the Technical Services Division, and the scientists involved were never punished. They served out their careers, receiving promotions and awards until they retired. After retirement, they continued to draw government pensions of up to $20,000 per year. On December 23, 1975, fate intervened on the behalf of the CIA. The CIA station chief in Greece, Richard S. Welch, was killed by terrorists in front of his villa in a luxurious suburb 8 kilometers from Athens. 3 days before, his name and CIA identity had been published in a local newspaper. No conceivable action or incident could have been more beneficial to the CIA at that time. Colby bitterly denounced the enemies of the CIA who were exposing it. A reaction set in on Capitol Hill and in the press community. Doors began to close on the congressional investigators in the rush of sympathy and support for CIA officers who were thought to be living hazardous lives in the service of their country. When church committee members traveled abroad to investigate CIA stations, they were berated by case officers' wives, who claimed that even their children were endangered by the committee's disclosures. The CIA officer's martyr role was only another CIA ploy. CIA case officering is certainly far less dangerous than other branches of the Foreign Service. During my 12 years of service, I knew of no other CIA case officer murdered, although at least 20 State Department, USIS, and aid officers had been killed, kidnapped, or suffered harrowing experiences during that period. This was despite the publication of hundreds of officers' names in recent years by enemies of the CIA. The reason is simple enough. 85% of all CIA field case officers already are well known in their local communities because of their liaison relationships with foreign police, their own open admissions of CIA identities, their freewheeling, high-profile lifestyles, and the gossip and conspicuous clannishness of their wives. In Abidjan, my first post, all CIA station personnel were listed in the embassy's unclassified public telephone book as the Political 2 section. Political 1 was legitimate State Department personnel. No one has been killing CIA case officers because no one cares to. The Soviets, Chinese, and even the North Koreans, like the CIA, do not want the intelligence world to be complicated by James Bond-type behavior. It isn't done. If a CIA case officer has a flat tire in the dark of night on a lonely road, he will not hesitate to accept a ride from a KGB officer. Likely, the two would detour to some bar for a drink together. Footnote. In fact, CIA and KGB officers entertain each other frequently in their homes. The CIA's files are full of mention of such relationships in almost every African station. End footnote. Terrorists are not going to waste suicidal missions on U.S. Embassy second secretaries, even if they are CIA. Terrorism requires dramatic targets, an Israeli Olympic team, an OPEC minister, a 747 jetliner, or at least an ambassador or consul general. In Athens, the CIA station was huge, and most of its personnel were well known in the local community. Its case officers, especially Welch and his predecessors, had separate offices in the embassy and passed the same residences to generations of successive case officers. Athens' chiefs of station had always been identified to a procession of changing Greek officials, and they had meddled in the violent crises of Cyprus, the Arab-Israeli conflicts, and in Greece itself. The significant point is not that Welch died as he did, but that other case officers before him and since were never hurt in any of these wars and coups. After Welch's death, the Church Committee ran out of support. It published its final report in April 1976, but the CIA was permitted to edit that report before it was released. The Pike Committee report on the CIA was completely suppressed. Although subsequently leaked to Daniel Shore, who had it conveyed to the Village Voice in New York. In July 1977, when the House of Representatives established an oversight committee to help keep the CIA in line, the agency immediately put the congressman on the defensive by charging they could not be trusted with its information. The representatives clamored publicly to reassure the CIA that they could keep secrets. Not one legislator promised to tell the American people if the CIA again abuses their rights or attempts to drag the nation into foolish wars. Footnote. See Intelligence the Constitution Betrayed, by Henry Steele Cumminger, New York Review, January 1976. End footnote. And while the oversight committees are preoccupied with proving to the CIA that they can keep a secret, the clandestine service continues to do its thing in most corners of the world.